Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyar. Earlier this month, a Fathom event, the creationist film called Is Genesis History, saw strong attendance in theaters across the country. That led to two encore performances, which were also well attended. In fact, I talked to many who have seen the show in Colorado and around the U.S. One couple told me they had to sit in the very first row because the theater was packed, and there were many others who reported, like the screenings that I went to, that the theaters were mostly full. The film was hosted by the amazingly successful Del Tackett and featured PhD scientists presenting the scientific evidence that refutes old Earth claims and testifies to a young Earth created by God. Well, one of those scientists who has quite a filmography of his own going, and the only one filmed underwater, I believe, was molecular biologist Dr. Rob Carter. Dr. Carter, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
Well, what an enjoyable program. After each of the showings, I asked people to, strangers, to join me right across the street in Golden, Colorado at a restaurant. And we talked literally for 2 hours after the showings, had such a wonderful time. People loved the film. So could you share with us the message of the film and your experience?
Well, I was invited to come into the project after some other people had recommended me, and I was not really sure what they were asking. But when I got to know Dell and Thomas, the director, I really said, they got a good thing going here. And so I said, okay, let's do this. And they brought me to the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is actually my first time ever going there. And we got to scuba dive, and I got to introduce both of them to scuba, which I really liked. It was a beautiful place. And in that place, we just sat down and talked about the wonders of God's creation, the complexity of God's creation, the crazy stuff happening inside life that Darwin had no idea of, and things like that.
So I believe you received your degree in marine biology. Is that right? You're a molecular biologist.
I'm not really a molecular biologist. Okay. I'm a geneticist.
Okay.
My training was in coral reef ecology, but I ended up in the genetics lab, and so the last half of my dissertation was on the genetics of corals. And since then, I've been studying the human genome, because genetics is genetics. I just, you know, transferred to humans from there.
So a geneticist who got his PhD in marine biology, and it was rather appropriate then for the film crew to take you to the Virgin Islands. And so Dell was scuba diving with you. Is that right? He is the host of the Truth Project, which has got to be the most successful presentation lecture series in the world, viewed by tens of millions of people.
Yeah, we went through that at my church.
Yeah, and we did too.
My biggest critique of the Truth Project, though, was that when they got to the age of the earth, they skirted around it.
Well, you know, I pastor Denver Bible Church. I don't know if you know that, Rob. And we're just up the street from Focus on the Family. They're in Colorado Springs. We're in Denver. And Focus on the Family has been old earth, you know, and the Reasons to Believe guys, they have gone that direction. So since Dell produced the Truth Project for Focus on the Family, I think that's why that happened.
Probably, but this was Dell correcting the record in a very powerful way.
Yeah.
Is Genesis History totally sets that record straight.
Yeah, it sure does. So, Rob, during the film, you guys were sitting by a tank. Actually, it was a beautiful setting. You reached in the water and you pulled up these amazing creatures. Could you describe the cucumber, the starfish, those creatures, and what was the message that you saw in those creatures?
Yeah, we were sitting there talking about God's creation, and I mean, it was not planned. It just happened to be three things in the tank. It was a touch tank at the aquarium, and all three things happened to be in the same phylum of life. They were echinoderms, you know, spiny skinned animals. like a sea urchin. So I picked up a sea urchin. We described it. And then I put that down and I picked up a starfish and described it. And I talked about how similar these things were and yet the differences that are built into them. And then I picked up a sea cucumber, which doesn't on the surface look like the other two. But when we flipped it over, we saw it had 2 feet and it had a lot of other similarities that put it into the same phylum, the echinoderms.
You just said tube feet, right? Not 2 feet.
Tube feet, yes.
Tube, T-U-B-E.
Tube feet.
Which is like these other, the sea urchin and the starfish.
Yeah, that's how a starfish can open up a clam. It wraps around it and it puts a whole lot of little tube feet on it. And each one doesn't pull very much, but when you have hundreds of them, it's enough force you can open up a clam slowly and then it can eat the clam.
Wow. Pork.
That's how a sea urchin holds onto rocks when the waves are hitting it. It takes its 2 feet and it just grabs onto the rocks. The waves don't wash it away.
You were making the point of variations on a theme when a creator has an idea of whether it's flight or creatures that could burrow into the ground or swim. Then we see this pattern throughout life of these variations on a theme.
Yes. And that's a critical thing to understand for creation. If Leonardo da Vinci was painting a series of pictures, or Rembrandt, or Picasso, you know, they tend to paint in groups. They'd take a theme and they'd work on it for a while, or sunflowers that Van Gogh painted. You know, he paints on a theme. Well, God did the same thing. God did things with themes. And when he turned to the echinoderms, he built similar organisms that have very similar DNA, very similar genetics, but he built them with very different body shapes. And it's a big mystery of how these body shapes came to be. Charles Darwin would say, slowly and gradually over many long years, little changes here and there in the ancestors to these organisms led to the evolution of sea urchins, starfish, and sea cucumbers. But when we actually look at what programs the shape of these animals, there are some very critical genes, and these genes produce massive changes, not little teeny changes, massive changes. They're called Hox genes. We have Hox genes. The reason that our left hand and our right hand are mirror images of one another, and they look the same and they're the same size, even though the cells that make up those our two hands weren't touching each other for most of the time in our mother's belly as we grew.
Right.
The reason that similarities can exist is because these Hox genes, they fire off in patterns, and there's timing. So it's literally like 1, 2, 3, 4, go, 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 5, 6, go, go, 7, 8, go. And as they set up these patterns, the patterns are reflected in our body shape. And the difference in these echinoderms we're talking about, it's the Hox genes. The patterns they set up change the shape of the organism. Now, it sounds like evolution can say, aha, see that? We just changed those genes and we can change a starfish into a sea cucumber or something like that. But the problem is it doesn't work because when you change those genes, you destroy the animal.
This has been tested extensively in the lab, of course, evolutionists for decades now. They would be ecstatic if they could go into a Hox gene, make a small change in the nucleotides, the arrangement of the information in the DNA there in that gene, and make a small change and see a different kind of animal emerge. But
yeah, they have failed, and the failure is dramatic.
Yes. With
the
lethal
changes we see are like after the animal's already developed, maybe it changes color, maybe grows a little bit larger, maybe gets an extra hair, loses a hair. You know, it's the end point of development that changes are tolerated. Early on in development, if you change anything, the whole system comes crashing down. And so even there, Darwinian evolution does not work once again.
And that has been one of the major avenues of investigation. And like so many of these, like the investigation of junk DNA, trying to show that the vast majority of the human genome is just junk, which you'd expect it to be if it was designed by mutations, errors after errors after errors, that avenue has been a dead end for Darwinist advocates. In fact, it's been a boon to creationists who have predicted that what they think is junk will have function. And so now here, the Hox genes, that's another area that had a major area of investigation that is coming to a dead end. So it seems that the arguments that have been used over the last half century or more for evolution, those arguments are shrinking. They're getting weaker and weaker, and gradually they're disappearing as more and more scientific knowledge is collected.
Especially the knowledge of genetics, which is something Darwin knew absolutely nothing about.
Well, in the film, you discussed what you call the four-dimensional genome. And it was exhilarating to hear that and to see the reaction and the comprehension of the audience in the theater. But Rob, when Gregor Mendel introduced the study of genetics, that information was rejected by Darwinists for decades. Yep. The journal Nature refused to publish. This was their editorial policy. They refused to publish any papers by geneticists because it was so obviously contrary to the expectations of Darwin that there would just be this very gradual morphing of functionality from one stage to another, whereas if you have some kind of digital information, some kind of code, that just doesn't lend itself to these gradual and never-ending changes.
Yes, and they thought, about 100 years after Mendel, they thought they had solved the problem with population genetics, and that lasted until about the 1950s when mathematicians started analyzing it. They survived up through the 1970s after they invented the idea of junk DNA. But now we're in the 21st century here. Mm. This is not something easy to answer for them anymore. We know too much detail. And the more complicated life becomes, the less possible evolution is. And the genetics revolution that we're seeing happen right under our noses is only showing that life is unbelievably complex and it's nothing that Darwin expected, and it's nothing even Darwinists up through the 1980s and 1990s even predicted. Mm. It has literally morphed underneath them into a monster that they're desperately trying to put a Darwinian explanation on.
Well, when the evolutionists tried to come to terms with genetics, they developed something called the modern synthesis. And there's a professor of biology at Oxford, Dennis Noble, and he has pointed out, to quote him, all the central assumptions of the modern synthesis, often called neo-Darwinism, have been disproved. So this is a theory that the high priest of it, like Richard Dawkins or P.Z. Myers, these guys, of course, they will not admit in public the crisis. But there are thousands of advanced degreed scientists who have recognized that the theory no longer could explain. In fact, it never could, but they're now acknowledging it cannot explain what we see in life, especially the molecular aspect of living organisms.
Yeah, it is not what they expect. I wrote an article, it's on creation.com now, called Slaying Yesterday's Dragons. Hmm. And I warn people that, yeah, we may have killed a Darwinian evolution, but that doesn't mean that people are going to turn to the Bible. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing in different college campuses amongst younger professors, they've been now schooled in the idea that mathematically Darwinism doesn't work. So what's possibly the answer? Well, they might turn to Gaia, or they might turn to the emergent hypothesis that, you know, complexity is just woven into the fabric of the universe and naturally emerges. Or they might say aliens did it.
Yeah,
and
aliens
really
did it. Of course,
watching that happen.
Of course, the aliens did it is wildly popular. It's what Richard Dawkins presented in the film Expelled with Ben Stein. Uh-huh. And the fallacy there is they're just punting because, well, then how did the aliens arise?
Exactly.
And this idea, of self-organization or some emergent properties in matter that matter wants to organize itself into these wildly sophisticated living organisms, that is mysticism. That's not science.
It is, and it's completely foreign to anything we see in the laboratory. We can get crystals to form, but it's pretty simple chemical and physical explanations for why, like a crystal would form spontaneously under the right conditions. But a crystal is nothing compared to DNA. DNA is no relationship to a crystal whatsoever. And not only that, even if you could get a string of DNA to form, that doesn't mean it's going to have an instruction set in it that's going to allow an organism to live.
Sure. There's a new film out from Illustra Media called Origins. It's out a few months ago. And they point out they got a little snail on a highway crossing the entire universe, bringing one atom from one end of the universe to the other. And they do this over and over and over and see how long it will take to form one protein. And it's just so wildly absurd for molecules to just happen to come together to form a protein. And I was interviewing the producer, Ladd Allen, and I asked him, well, what would happen if it did form? And if it did form, nothing would happen. It would just fall apart. It's not like the universe would say, okay, there's a protein, now let's build something else. So the whole concept of a biogenesis is completely lacking in any kind of substance.
Yep.
So then...
But what else are they going to do?
Yeah.
They got to believe in something.
If you reject the creator God, then you're driven to absurdities and ignorance. So
Yes. In
the film, you then mentioned what you referred to as, in fact, you have an article about this, the four-dimensional genome. So,
which is available on creation.com also.
Yes, creation.com, real easy to find. In fact, I have it up right here. So let's explain, first of all, and I hate to do this over and over, but you always have new listeners in the audience who don't know what DNA is. So DNA is an instruction set, and it looks sort of like a spiral staircase, but only it goes on and on and on. If the DNA, the strand of DNA in the cells in our body, and there's trillions of these DNA strands, if it was as thick as a human hair, which it's not, it's way thinner than that, but you mentioned how long that strand would be. Do you recall that?
32 miles long.
How long?
32 miles.
So in every one of our cells, not our red blood cells, right? They don't have a nucleus, but in trillions of our...
They have mitochondria, but not a nucleus. So they do have some DNA.
Okay. But in trillions of our cells in the nucleus, there's all this tiny thin strand of DNA wrapped up. And if that strand was as thick as a human hair, you're saying it would be 32 miles long. That's astounding and beyond measure.
Oh, but it's worse than that, because at that scale, the nucleus would be the size of a golf ball.
Okay.
So you have 32 miles of hair packed into something the size of a golf ball, and it's an active computer program that the cellular computer can read and act upon and search. And say, I need to find this gene. Where's that gene? Oh, here it is. How on earth do you do that?
Where is that gene? So to help the audience understand what you just said a little bit better, on our computers, we have hard drives. We have all kinds of flash drives. We have the cloud, the internet, and we have ways to access that information, indices, an index to say, okay, you want a calculator program on your cell phone? Well, we have an alphabetical listing of programs, and here in the C's is a calculator, and here's a pointer to where you find that program in your memory, in your hard drive, or wherever it is, and then it appears on your screen. So in a living organism, if it needs a certain gene to perform a function, right now at this point, it's somewhere on that 32 miles of hair that are all wound together incredibly tightly in this golf ball sized nucleus. So it has to find it. So just that aspect is bewildering even to our most sophisticated engineers and scientists.
And probably the thing that it needs to find is buried in an inactive state, wound up in an inaccessible pocket of DNA. So it has to actually go through all the stuff, unwind it, unfold it. Oh, here it is. Use it. And then when it's done, it has to fold it all back up again and put everything away.
It has to fold it back up and keep it neat and orderly, because it has thousands of other genes at every moment that need to be copied, because they need to be expressed for the organism to perform its biological functions. So that's information on this strand that I described as a spiral staircase. Each step on that staircase is a nucleotide. It's potentially a letter with genetic information on it.
Yes.
So that would be
3 billion of those letters.
How many?
3 billion.
Okay.
In one human genome, but all of your cells carry two human genomes, because you got one from mom and one from dad.
Okay.
So you have 6 billion letters in each cell, and literally, that DNA, if you stretch it out, it will be 6 feet long.
So the actual strand, if you don't make it thick like a human hair, but the actual strand about 6 feet.
About 6 feet, packed into every single one of the 100 trillion cells in your body.
Oh my. The glory of God comes through in the film. Rob, is Genesis history, and I'm thrilled that it's coming out so quickly on DVD. That's April 11th. But the way that you're describing this, and that the production quality of the film is superb. It's a beautiful film to watch, thoroughly enjoyable, totally intellectually exhilarating. But so then, this is the first dimension that you're describing, right? These 3 billion letters, but you got a copy from your mom, a copy from your dad. So really 6 billion, all in one long strand. So that's the first
dimension.
Remember
in math class,
yeah,
we learned that a line is one dimension. Hmm. So DNA is a line. It's a string. It has one dimension. You can start at the beginning and read the whole thing in an order from the beginning to the end in a line. Hmm. But that line controls, let's see, if you had to like write out which piece of DNA interacts with which other piece of DNA, you'd have to print the DNA out in a book, and you'd have about 850 Bibles stacked on top of each other. That's how much DNA you have in one human genome.
In one cell.
And then you have to make all these notes to say, okay, when you get to this letter here, go to page 6,422, find the 17th letter, start from there, and then that will turn something off. And then over here on page 99,003, this goes back to page 7, and this is going to turn something on.
Yeah, and the things that are being
network.
And the things that are being turned on or off, the information in this one dimension of the human genome, it has instructions for how to build these little, some of them are like little machines, they're proteins or enzymes. Enzymes are sort of fancy proteins. No, is that an amateur way?
Well,
of
we use that term kind of loosely.
Yeah.
In biochemistry, you learn that an enzyme is something that makes a reaction
causes
go more
a reaction.
Quickly.
Right.
But there are some really complicated things we call enzymes that do all sorts of crazy things. I mean, they're enzymes that interfere with DNA, cut DNA, involved in chemical reactions, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so when you said at page 99,347, get this and bring it back to something that's on page 7, and it's going to turn something on over there. So on page 7, there might be the code for a certain kind of protein that you need to digest, a certain kind of food that maybe you've never eaten before. And so you need that protein. And so way over here on a different part of the strand is the information to, okay, now go over here and start making these kinds of proteins. So that's what you're describing
Complicated, crazy complicated. Hmm. But that's just two dimensions. Let's say it this way. If you wrote out the DNA onto one giant sheet of paper, and then you drew arrows from one point to another point where all these pieces of DNA talk to each other, you'd have a giant two-dimensional sheet and all these connections all over the entire sheet from one end to the other in the middle, back and forth. It'd be a two-dimensional thing.
I see. Okay, awesome.
But the third dimension of the genome is the way it folds up into a 3D shape. It was really funny. After the human genome was first published, one of the first papers I read, some evolutionists went through and they said, okay, we predict that genes that are used together in some biochemical pathway will be found next to each other in the genome. And it turns out they're not. They're, in fact, pretty much random. Genes that are used together can be found on different chromosomes, very different parts of the genome. One could be backwards, one could be forwards. And the evolutionists say, look at that, it's just junk. Millions of years of evolutionary baggage, all these random changes and all these accidents and mistakes built up over millions of years to explain the human genome.
Right.
Well, that didn't last very long. Because not too long later, some group of scientists took the genome and said, okay, yeah, but what happens if we fold it up? And what they realized is that once you take that string and fold it into three dimensions, genes that are used together actually are next to each other in three-dimensional space.
Oh my.
Even if they're on different chromosomes, the way the chromosomes fold up brings the genes next to each other. So a gene family, they can all be turned on at the same time, and they tend to be in a little pocket that's maybe near a nuclear pore. So So after they all get turned on and copied, those copies go right out into the nucleus and can be instantly turned into protein as a group.
Okay. So
wow, my brain exploded when I learned that. I was like, this is crazy. I didn't even imagine the genome could be that complicated. That was just the beginning of it.
Okay. So yeah. Let's take the human hair again, and it's 32 miles long, and you've got billions of instructions on that hair, and it's all wound up into really 46 different major packets, right, or chromosomes. We get 23 from our mom, 23 from our dad, and that's what early on in the history of the discovery of all this, they looked in a microscope, and that's what they were seeing initially, right? They had the count wrong. I forget what the count was. I think they thought it was 48 chromosomes, and that lasted for quite a few years.
Yeah, that was back in the early days.
Yeah, and it lasted for some years, and students at a college class would look and say, yeah, but it's 46, and the teacher would correct them. No, it's 48, and eventually they realized, okay, it's 46. But so wound in that 32 miles of human hair is bunched up into 46 packets. And somewhere like 3 miles in is information for one kind of protein. 17 miles in is information for another protein. 31 miles in is information for another. And then when you wind all that up and bunch it all together, all those three get exposed at the surface of that bunch.
Yeah, in the same place.
Because they're
so
needed
whoever
together.
Whoever programmed that one-dimensional string of all those letters knew that when it folded up, he put things on that string knowing that when it folded up, those things could be used together. It's not junk. It's not random. It's incredibly well engineered.
Okay, so Rob, in other words, if these genes developed just materialistically, naturally, with no foresight, no planning, and they just happen to be wherever on the strand, there's no reason that when the strand folds in three dimensions, that the ones that are needed together would appear together on the surface. That would be wildly absurd to think that that would happen just coincidentally.
Yeah, but it also means it's very difficult to evolve humans and chimpanzees from a common ancestor.
Why is that?
Well, because the biggest difference between us is not the genes, it's the way the genes are expressed in that three-dimensional shape. And if you change that three-dimensional shape, you mess up the functioning of the entire genome. You can't just change it at will. There's some things you can change, but most of it you can't change because you'll destroy some very important biochemical pathway.
So the thought that you just change a nucleotide here and there, you flip one of the genetic letters to another letter, A, T, G, C, you just change them. And then with enough of those changes, voila, you've got, you know, our brains get bigger or whatever. But the reality is it's far beyond just the order of the information in that first dimension of the strand. It's far beyond
it's
that.
Not just the sequence. The sequence, it's another level above that, another level above that, and we haven't even gotten to the fourth level yet.
Okay, so we're at the third dimension of the human genome, and this is not only humans, it's in all organisms. Like you said earlier, this is how DNA works. But then I got to put a seatbelt on to get to the fourth dimension, because you describe it in the film. So could you help us understand it?
All right. Fourth dimension is time. Now everyone says, yeah, of course the fourth dimension is time. What do you mean about the genome? Well, the genome changes over time. The shape changes. The interactions change, and that initial string, that code, changes. There are little things in the genome. They're called jumping genes or retrotransposons, and evolutionists of a long time said, oh, these are just junk, you know, vestigial pieces of leftover viral infections from thousands or millions of years ago. Well, these retrotransposons in brain cells, as you're developing in utero, your brain cells are producing sometimes, you know, hundreds of thousands of neurons a minute. And these little retrotransposons are popping out, copying themselves to different parts of the genome and changing the type of brain cell that that brain cell will become.
Oh my.
So different brain cells have different genomes.
In other words, the program, Bill Gates described the human DNA molecule as the most sophisticated computer program that we know of, far beyond anything that we could produce.
I'd say almost exactly the same thing, yes.
Yes. So then it sounds like with our computer programming, if someone at IBM wrote self-modifying code where the code changes itself as the program runs, maybe they'd get fired. You don't do that. And the reason you don't write self, I used to work for Microsoft up in Redmond. You don't write self-modifying code because it's too wildly complex. It might be efficient. It might be sophisticated, but it's impossibly complex. No one else but you would understand it. And if anything goes wrong, it's just, oh, and by the way, our producer here and our board operator is a retired IBM engineer with some patents to his name. So we're honored to have Larry as a producer. But it sounds like this human DNA, it modifies itself over time. And that's what you're describing. It's self-modifying over time. So time is the fourth dimension?
Yes. In the mouse embryo, they discovered that these things they thought were junk DNA, these jumping genes, these retrotransposons, that if you deactivate one certain retrotransposon, the mouse embryo will stop developing. It gets up to a certain point and just stops.
Mm.
In other words, that retrotransposon, that's supposedly a piece of junk DNA, which jumps around and rewrites pieces of the genome, is actually intrinsically important to development of the animal.
Mm.
It's part of the program. It's not junk DNA.
It's not junk. So many of the stretches of DNA that the evolutionists have claimed, and they really fight. They continue to fight to say, no, this is junk. It's junk. It's junk. And it might have a binding site right smack in the middle of it, which is so crucial. It might be a developmental gene, which is so crucial, but they'll argue, no, this was junk. This was junk. And a human and two chimp chromosomes fused right here. And so it's junk, even though it's all obviously vital to survival.
Yes. Now, it doesn't mean that every single letter of the genome codes for an important function.
No.
Because we're talking about a three-dimensional structure. Some of that DNA, those stretches of repeating units, might just be scaffolding that holds the genes in a three-dimensional position.
Exactly, of course.
So it might not like say, I'm a very important piece of DNA, but it might be like, no, you're a girder in a building. So when we take away the girder, the building might collapse.
The building collapses.
But it doesn't mean that.
And so that structure is functional. It would be incorrect to say, even if you have long strands of repeating over and over and over the same sequences, to say, oh, look, it's not functional, that could be a statement of ignorance because, like you just said, Rob, it's the scaffolding that holds it together. The scaffolding is not non-functional. It is crucially functional.
That's right. Now, it doesn't code for protein.
No.
But the genome has got a lot of functions other than just coding for protein. Protein might be the output, but in order to have that output, you need a computer, and a computer needs some architecture. It has to be put together properly to do that final thing that it's designed to do.
Right. Hey, Rob, you mentioned mouse DNA, and another hat that I wear is we fight to protect the lives of unborn children, protect every child by love and by law without exception. And we were looking, went to the local university library to see in their text, when does life begin? And so in anatomy book on the mouse, on page one, it says the life of the mouse begins when the egg is fertilized by a sperm. It was just so, I mean, it's like the first sentence practically. There's no politics involved. So
yeah, so they're free to say that for the mouse.
Right, exactly. Yes.
But, you know, speaking biologically, as soon as fertilization occurs, nothing is going to stop the development of an adult person except violence.
Mm. Wow.
That egg cell, that fertilized egg, there is no distinction between it genetically and an adult.
Mm.
There is nothing to prevent it from becoming an adult. It's a stepwise process from one cell, two cells, four cells, eight cells, all the way up to 100 trillion cells. There's no dividing line that you can draw, say, okay, this is human and this isn't. The only dividing line is pre-fertilization.
Wow, what a great point.
An egg only has half a genome. A sperm only has half a genome.
Right.
That's not a person.
Right. And pro-abortion people will mock Christians, creationists, pro-lifers, and they'll imply that every sperm cell, every egg is a person, and there is just this great inhumanity if any of those are destroyed. And of course, it's utter biological ignorance, and it's also moral and spiritual ignorance.
That's right. You know, of course they paint us in a negative light. They're fighting a battle and they know it. I just wish more Christians understood the battle that they're fighting.
Yes. In their rebellion against God, they lust to destroy unborn children because as innocent as those children are and made in God's image, it's one of the most powerful ways they have to express their hatred of God, to destroy those made in God's image and likeness. So, Rob, that's the genome in four dimensions. Boy, I'm just so thankful that you are doing all you are to help people realize that the more we learn about science, about genetics, the more obviously there had to be a creator who had the whole vision from the beginning of what he wanted to accomplish, and then he began to implement that vision. And that is what you explain so wonderfully at creation.com. Four-dimensional genome is the URL there. In fact, creation.com is the website of the organization you work for, CMI. As we close, yep. Can you tell us a bit about CMI?
Well, CMI, or Creation Ministries International, we're a 40-year-old ministry. We have offices in seven different countries in the English-speaking world. And we've got about 30 full-time people on the road every weekend or every other weekend, most of us, going to churches, talking about the Bible, talking about science, and trying to encourage people that you don't have to turn your brain off when you become a Christian. Mm. The Bible is good history. The Bible is good science. Evolution does not work as advertised, and we don't have to kowtow to the evolutionary community just to win respect. We can actually stand on our own two feet, use the Bible as a guide, and trust it as written.
Mm. Well, Dr. Robert Carter, what a thrill, what an honor to have you on Real Science Radio again. I really appreciate your time, Rob.
Oh, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. The film is called Is Genesis History? It was a Fathom event, which means a one-time event in theaters nationwide. But because it was so well attended, there was an encore presentation and then another encore presentation. But I think now we have to wait until April 11th to get it on DVD. And I know that that will be available at creation.com. Just click on their store. Probably you could already pre-order. And so we will be getting copies here at Real Science Radio. So for Fred Williams and myself, Bob Enyart, this is Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.